6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. No power frequency, radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication. And welcome to this Monday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host, John Quinlan. Coming up today, our conduct of war abroad is turned increasingly to corporation-based contracting schemes that often exploit and lie waste to the lives of all the folks involved. No one knows this better than acclaimed author Janet Burraway of Lake Geneva, who lost her soldier contractor son to suicide a decade ago last week. Her book, Losing Tim, is a compellingly written memoir that unravels the mystery of why her son died by revealing how he lived and how a badly broken and corrupt American war machine ultimately failed him. The book she's written has important lessons to anyone contemplating the what-ifs behind a loved one's internal battles with depression and suicide, alongside lessons learned about the overriding need for all good people of conscience to speak out against a greed-based, multinationally-run corporate war system that really serves no one, regardless of ideology or principled belief. And Janet Burraway was at heart a pacifist who nonetheless grew to accept her oldest son's dedication to the U.S. military as part of who he was. Her son Tim was an unapologetic lover of guns and military culture who also led courageous efforts in clearing away mines that ultimately saved countless lives. You know, such are among just a few of the complicated and multifaceted realities that Janet shares with us in Losing Tim, which is published by the Minneapolis-based Think Peace Publishing. Janet Burraway has written 8 novels, countless other poems and plays, as well as the best-selling how-to book in the U.S. on the art of creative writing. But in this intensely autobiographical work, she's accomplished something few authors ever truly achieve, a look back at a family's life stories in ways that contain deeply expressed lessons about the meaning of life that are relevant to us all. Now, no matter what your belief system or ideology, when it comes to larger questions around the role of the military and the efficacy of war, she raises important questions worthy of our consideration with a book as powerfully moving as any I've read in recent times. Please join us today in conversation with Janet Burraway. Janet, welcome to A Public Affair.
Thank you so much. My pleasure, John.
It's so good to have you here. I thought that maybe, first of all, I just wanted to establish your... On a lighter note, one of the things that fascinated me in talking to your publisher, Adam, is unlike a lot of snowbirds who start out in Wisconsin and move down to Florida, you're someone who actually chose to move
north.
We came
the other way. Yes, we always say we retired backwards.
That's right.
And this winter, I have to say, when people told my husband he was crazy to have moved north, I said, how does that make you feel when people say you're crazy? He said, it makes me feel crazy. However, I spent my childhood in Arizona and 35 years in Tallahassee, Florida, and I was ready for cold.
Yeah.
I think winter should be cold, so I had no complaints.
I think you write evocatively, too. You know, some of your early trips here were in the fall, the colors, the variety. Is that something?
I love that. Yeah. Right now we're seeing the daffodils out and the peonies coming up, and this is something that you don't see in either Arizona or in Florida. So.
Well, we're very pleased to have you here.
Thank you so much.
2007? Was
2007, yes.
It was about the time that you came with us. Yeah. Well, as I was explaining to you, I think a good way to move into this subject is, of course, we need to zero in on, of course, the event that is the centerpiece of your book. Mm-hmm. Your book is a memoir, and it really does evoke the totality of your life, the life of your loved ones. But, of course, it all comes down to a day that I guess was the anniversary was just this last Wednesday.
Last Wednesday was 10 years since his death, yes.
Mm-hmm. And... I think that the book is in some ways sort of a detective story or an attempt to put pieces together to try to figure out what happened.
You know,
what was behind
this. Have talked to several people who felt that mystery story impulse as well after a suicide. You have to ask what was it that made a person lose their life and make the choice to do so. So I think there is always an attempt to figure out, and always a failure to figure out. You know, at some point you must realize that you can go no further.
And we'll have a chance to explore some of this. Some of that involves, the inevitable second guessing someone does. Is something I could have done differently. Wondering, childhood
incidents of falling on the stairs and having a concussion, or if a shock of a lamp that was poorly grounded or something like that might have.
And now every time I read about the continuing problems that young football players have, I think, is this something that happened to Tim because he was 6 years old when he hit his head on a step? And was unconscious for a while and had a concussion.
You know, and I think I had to backtrack after I put some of the initial things out as I finished the book, and I realized it isn't necessarily a foregone conclusion that you feel that Tim's experience as a soldier contractor in Iraq was directly connected to post-traumatic stress. I know that this litigated its way through the courts, but it's very complicated.
It's very complicated. In some ways, I have come to feel that the diagnosis of PTSD is meaningless in the way that we put a label on something that is so complex. And the label has the effect in the military of making some soldiers feel ashamed of it.
Right.
And the culture is very much, you know, don't be a wuss in the military. So that prevents people from looking for help. At the same time, when they go for help, this label is put on them, and then they have a disorder. And so I think... our personal experience was that my daughter-in-law sued not the government, but the insurance company of the contractor that had employed my son. It's very complicated, but I'll simplify it. The DBA, the Defense-Based Act, says that if you contract people to work for the United States government, you have to have insurance for them. And she sued for benefits, but it came down to, in the trial, a question of did he or did he not have PTSD. And since there was no diagnosis before his death, it was impossible to prove that he had PTSD.
And the nature of who he was existing in that culture probably meant he didn't necessarily reveal clues to that. What occurred in the context of his military service.
I must say that on the last day of his life, he did say, get me some help.
Yeah.
On the last day, but he didn't wait for it.
Well, one of the other multiple clues, I know the gentleman who writes the introduction to your book alludes
to something
about...
Jonathan Shea.
Yeah, and he's someone who's an advocate for other folks who are in this situation of being a contractor.
He has worked with Vietnam veterans for 20 years.
I'm trying to remember sort of the seminal case he cites of a colonel that...
of Colonel Westhusing.
Yeah.
Who, a year after Tim died... died under similar circumstances in that he had been at West Point and he went to oversee a contract in Iraq because he wanted to understand what it was like for his men. And shortly before he apparently shot himself, he wrote his family that he had gone for an honorable mission and had been dishonored by his... by the contamination of the contractor that he worked for.
Yeah, I guess that's a good way to put this up. We said, as I was saying at the outset, I think most of our listeners today are probably, in a mind of being advocates for peace. They're probably somewhat cynical about the system in general, about the Halliburtons of the world and the corporate forces that
absolutely
work here. But just as I think we had to during the Vietnam War back away from blaming veterans for what's going on here, there's probably a similar lesson in terms of contractors.
Yes, it is a similar lesson, except that I think there's a wide range here and a wide range of attitudes that you can have. Let me start here. The split that I think we have in our reaction to contractors and soldiers is our brave young men and women who have gone to fight for our freedom.
And they've done it selflessly.
That's the armed
forces.
The heroes.
And little compensation. They've done it.
Yeah.
They've been sent back multiple times, probably not necessarily, willingly. And so contractors are sort of in a different category because of
contractors,
intention and in
contractors are those sleazebags, Now, the fact is that most of the contractor employees are veterans. And many of them, like my son, went into the Army with great idealism and a sense of right and have gone on to take these jobs as contractors because that's what America is doing now. Half of the people in Iraq and Afghanistan, more than half, were contractors. And some of those contractors were from Middle Eastern countries, paid very little to peel the potatoes, and some of them were highly skilled medical officers. Some of them, like my son, were recent veterans who went to do various kinds of job. My son's situation was that he was in love with the Army all his life.
Yeah.
He admired the warrior spirit and the honor of the warrior spirit. Never got over his love of the toys of war.
This is in a family where his mom was essentially a child of the 60s, was very much anti-war.
Very
and,
much.
And this must have been kind of
And his little brother as
yeah.
well.
Yeah, yeah.
So his little brother and I, who are very much alike, were very anti-war. And Tim, I have to say that I recognized early on that his sense of the honor of the military was very genuine, and it was not warmongering.
Yeah,
it was that sense of wanting to be a hero. He did want to be a hero.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt, but this is a profound struggle you're describing, though. It's the red and the blue state. I mean, I have a sister
Absolutely.
Who lives in rural, outside of Tulsa, Oklahoma, who's a conservative Republican in Oklahoma.
Right.
How did this happen in my
how
family?
How did this happen?
But there are still shared values. There's love. There's all kinds of other things when you have someone who chooses a different path. And then it's just trying to figure out how that happens and how you find common ground. It's a challenge.
My parents were Republicans,
uh-huh.
staunch Republicans. And I think that was good for me because it did teach me that a family could be loving and coherent, even though there were different worldviews. But I have to say it was a struggle all my life, you know.
Yeah.
And Tim and I acknowledged it. That helped. We were able to talk about the fact that our task was to love each other without sharing a worldview.
But to show how profound this is, you just bring up so many details. He was 5 years old. He could name all the different types of German warcraft in World War II.
He knew more about the Battle of Britain than I know now at five.
And he had toy soldiers. He played war games.
I was a first-time mother, and I didn't know when little boys were supposed to grow out of that
yeah.
kind of play, and did not really realize it until his little brother outgrew the toy soldiers and went on to role-playing games, Dungeons and Dragons. Nerdy stuff, you know.
Big Bang Theory type folks.
Right. And his elder brother was still... those little 2-inch plastic soldiers that you buy 32 a plastic bag,
right.
you know? He used to sit with those when he was 11, 12 years old, and a 2 or 3 hair brush, and put the camouflage on these tiny little soldiers, and then the patina on their belts, and their little insignias, and their eyes had whites and irises and pupils. I mean, it was just an intense concentration, a labor of love on something that I could not understand at all.
So someone who was an important role model, sort of a surrogate father in his life, maybe we can bring into the discussion, because I think he kind of helps describe this dynamic tension between some of your values, some of what he was getting in other places. I'm trying to remember his name, but he was someone Rob Jones. He was a Green Beret
He was a Green Beret.
And you were involved in a relationship with him for a time.
I was for a time, and he came to FSU after he left the Army to get a PhD in English, and I was teaching English.
Yeah.
So we met, and we were in a relationship for a while, which my friends thought was a major mismatch for me. But through it, Tim, in a sense, found his what he called the father of my spirit.
Hmm.
And Rob was a kind of gung-ho macho soldier type, which I did not really love. but Tim did. And because Tim had always had a problematic relationship with his father, he needed this role model. And I deeply respect the feeling that Rob and Tim had for each other long after he and I were, you know, an item.
You come back to this basic dichotomy that, again, is behind red and blue states and other things. I think he recognized there was a certain integrity and something to admire in some ways, the way that this belief system expressed itself.
Yes.
It was based on essentially coming from a good place.
Yes, yes, it was coming from a good place, and yet... You know, and
yeah.
yet, I think that our culture is set up in a way that allows young men to make a choice that that is going to lead them into very difficult situations. That the macho is still very strong in our culture.
And what this meant, I think, in practice, it sounds for Tim, where, for example, to flash ahead to later in his career, He had a commanding officer who was very erratic.
Yes.
And yet the military culture was he needed to follow this guy and follow him all over the place, no matter what his whim was or other things, to do the right thing in his mind, really tore him apart because he was doing the wrong thing in the process,
right.
too.
Right. I ran into that to Jonathan Shea's two wonderful books of Achilles in Vietnam and Odysseus in America after I had written this book. And I'm glad that it was after, because I have a sense that if I had discovered the phrase moral injury before I wrote the book, I would have thought that's the answer. I can look through Tim's past in the Army and see several places, several times that he might have felt morally injured. And that was one. He was 3 years in the ROTC and then 4 years in the Army and then 8 years in the reserve. And he left the Army after those 4 years, which he had not intended to do, because he was the executive officer for a colonel that could not make up his mind. And once he'd made up his mind, changed it in the middle of the night, several times, over and over. It made Tim feel this was a group of a battalion that was going off to Desert Storm. And it made Tim feel that the colonel was endangering these soldiers. And he felt himself to be in a terrible dilemma. He went to the chaplain and said, I think I should go over his head. And the chaplain said, I agree, you should go over his head, but of course that will end your career. So rather than do that, Tim ended his career, except that, of course, he went immediately to join the reserve.
Yeah. Well, and along the way, he was involved in corporate settings and sales jobs and other things that really kind of sapped his energy, his soul. He could do them but...
He would spend 6 months in a financial officer or as a computer headhunter and just hate wearing a suit, being in an office. He always wanted to be in the field. That same colonel caused a lighthearted moment when Tim called me and said, well, the colonel told me, I know you want to be in the field, Isolink, but I got to have somebody that can write.
Oh.
I said, your genes will out.
Yeah.
But that colonel eventually, Tim said to me on the phone one day as he was in this dilemma about whether to go to Desert Storm with this colonel, he said, I just have a feeling that if I go, I will be medevaced out, psych medevaced out in 6 months.
Turns out
the person who took over from him was psych medevaced out in 6 months.
So the other aspect of his career that's important to mention, and of course it probably resonates with your own view of you know, wanting your son to do the right thing and be able to help folks, is a lot of his career was spent as a minesweeper, someone who would in contexts like Ethiopia and Eritrea, in Namibia, where eventually he ended up and where he took his life. His work was to take the vestiges of war and to find a way to take that harm, that potential harm away, and in the process probably save a number of lives or folks that would have faced decapitation or some really horrible things.
My brother pointed that out to me after Tim died, that we will never know how many people saved all their limbs or were born at all because Tim did the job that he did. This is interesting with regard to the contractor brave young men dichotomy. When Tim was in the reserve, he volunteered for everything in sight for those 8 years. And so he went first to Bosnia-Herzegovina, and then he was for brief times in Cameroon and Angola and Sierra Leone and Nigeria and Angola. And his last job as a reserve soldier was to run the operation of humanitarian demining that the government of the United States was giving to Namibia. So he was in Windhoek, Namibia, working out of the embassy.
Just briefly to establish, for folks who may not know where this is just to the west of South Africa. It was a former...
It's just north of
Northwest on the coast
right.
there. It was a former protectorate of South Africa, kind of a complicated political history here. But
right.
But there was a civil war with Angola.
That's right.
A group named SWAPO that laid many of these mines, other things.
Right.
So essentially, we're coming in trying to undo the damage of that civil war.
Yes, and those mines were laid along the power line, so they threatened the country's entire power source.
Mm.
And so Tim ran the operation from the embassy that was done by a contractor in the field. And there are many different ways of getting rid of mines. I didn't know this before Tim got into it. But in that particular instance, they were he was ordering bulletproof bulldozers that they then took to the power lines, and they would shove the dirt into huge berms. The bulldozers were bulletproof, of course, in case the mines blew up while they were doing this. But then they would explode them after they had them in the berms. So he kept describing this to me as not very dangerous, which I guess that means was not very dangerous. At any rate, here's the thing. At the end of his 2 years in Namibia, the army decided that they were no longer going to staff that particular position of the person who ran the operation from the embassy. Instead, they were going to give it to the company that did the field operation. Well, at the time, it seemed to Tim and it seemed to me that this was a piece of luck. He could leave the reserve, wait for clearance, and then go back and do this job as the task leader in this minesweeping operation as a civilian. And it was well paid. And he had, in the meantime, fallen in love in Namibia with a third-generation Namibian, German, Dutch colonial.
That was Birgit, who in later life pursued this case.
That's right.
The courts and
that's right.
Is in the States now.
It was
yes.
Birgit. And she had an 8-year-old son. And when Tim went back to finish the job in Namibia as a contractor, they got married and they had a child. And he then, after that job was done, went to Ethiopia to do a similar thing on the Eritrean-Ethiopian border, where during the war a lot of mines had been laid. Digression, it costs $2.50 to lay a mine.
Yeah.
It costs $1,000 to take one out of the ground.
Wow.
And it costs $2,500 for a prosthetic limb. Do the math. You know, this is a scourge in the world.
Yeah.
All of these mines that have been laid. So I was very, not only proud of him that he was doing this difficult humanitarian job, but I also felt lucky that he was doing this instead of putting mines in the ground, which I also knew as a soldier he would willingly have done.
Yeah, yeah. So the other piece of the puzzle is, as we make our transition into the piece of music I had announced we were going to play, that, and now I think we've kind of set the stage for, as you mentioned, at this stage, back in 2004, he had been married for a couple of years, had a young child, Tira.
4 years they'd
four,
been.
4 years.
Well, nearly six, I guess, by that time. Because after the Ethiopian job, he was given the option of a desk job in Washington or Iraq.
Yeah.
And he went enthusiastically to Iraq, believing in the war and Bush and Bremer and thinking that that it was necessary.
I guess just the other piece to juxtapose it. So you know, his life was spent very much as a global citizen in many ways. He grew up in England, a little town just north of Brighton.
Was born in Belgium.
Was born in Belgium. His father was Belgian.
Right.
Belgian, is that right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And to mirror this, you know, many of his early relationships were always with women of unusual, I mean, a background.
Unusual backgrounds. Well, yes.
Definitely not just in an American woman from Georgia, for example.
Right.
One of his significant relationships just before his marriage was with a young woman who is the daughter of Sikh immigrants from India.
That's right. Yes.
And so again, he's at that stage. You know, his brother Alex, I know, was married and kind of jokingly told him, you know, I beat you. I got the first. You
I
know,
got the first baby. Yeah.
Baby and all of that. But it sounds like he was settling into a time. You make this contrast in the book about sort of the satisfactions of the living room, sort of the satisfactions of domestic life versus, you know, life, I guess, out in the world or other things. Again, this dynamic tension, this pull that he felt in both directions.
He did feel that pull strongly. And I understand that. I felt it myself. I think probably anybody who grew up in the 50s and 60s felt it. I mean, any woman, the pull between the domestic and the work. But it was easier for me because the pull between the domestic and the work was between home and writing. For him, it was the adventure out there, or home life. And he did suffer from that pull, I think.
So again, if we move back to that week, April 23rd of 2004, mm-hmm. He had been in this marriage of several years. He had a young daughter whom he loved deeply. He was beginning. He also had this expansive notion of family that folks who were his half relations or his step relations were part of his family.
Absolutely, so there was no step or half in his vocabulary.
So Neil, who was eight at the time, was his son for all practical purposes. Mm-hmm. So against this backdrop of great security and other things, something was going on. And you're trying to figure out after the fact, after the fact of his suicide, what that was. And one of the clues was, it sounds like there was this song, Behind Blue Eyes, this classic from The Who that at the time was, there was a version by, I think, Limp Bizkit, bands. It was all over the radio. And in retrospect, his wife, Birgit, was thinking he had turned up the volume on this song, and there was some kind of significance, but she couldn't figure out, you know, no one knows what it's like to be a bad man. Well, that could possibly mean Tim was not a bad man.
Yeah.
And so what I ask our listeners to do now as we play this song is to listen to those lyrics, because I think there's some deep insights into this conundrum, into this struggle that Tim was going through inside, and we'll have some reflections on that on the other end. But just about a minute and a half now, the Limp Bizkit version of Behind Blue Eyes.
It's like to be the bad man, to be the sad man, behind blue eyes. And no one knows what it's like to be hated, to be faded, to telling only lies. But my dreams, they aren't as empty as my conscience seems to be. I have hours of lonely. My love was vengeance. Let's never fear. No one knows what it's like to feel these feelings like I do. And I blame you.
And welcome back to A Public Affair, as we explained, playing this song, Behind Blue Eyes, that had some deeper meanings, and we'll explore that in just a moment. But just want to reset the show for those of you who may be joining us in midstream. And we're in conversation with Janet Burroway, and she's the author of just a remarkable book called Losing Tim, and it discusses the life story of her son, Tim, who was lost to suicide 10 years ago this last week. And he was a soldier contractor, the context of Iraq, and someone who removed mines from different places in the world where conflict had been. Someone who whose life philosophy is in some ways a little bit different than his mom's, who was an advocate for peace throughout her life and other things. But it's a wonderful story of coming to grips with and understanding someone that you care about who may have walked a different path. And in this case, of course, uncovering some of the mysteries behind why he chose to take his life. We just want to mention at the outset, because of the nature of this subject, and because, of course, it may hit home with some of you who have lost a loved one, who are dealing with issues of depression, suicide within your own families, to know that there is help, there is assistance out there. Two numbers to just share with you, and we've got these at the front desk as well if you need them. Here locally, the Journey Mental Health Center has a crisis line for folks who are dealing with these issues. That number is area code 608-280-2600, 280-2600. There, if you're listening from further afield, there's also a National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. That number is 1-800-273-8255. 1-800-273-8255. I should just note that probably in early summer, a good friend of mine named Greg Converse, who also lost his brother to suicide about 10 years ago, a little more than that, will be our guest. He's also written a book about that experience. He's helped to lead support groups locally, and so this is a subject that we will be revisiting. Again, for those of you for whom this is a difficult subject, I think one of the things I learned in talking to a friend who works in the mental health arena last night was, though, it's all right to talk about this stuff. As much as we're concerned that somehow this will evoke something, or, you know, the notions of copycat actions that occur in other realms, probably the overriding truth is how important it is to talk about this so that other folks who are facing it know that there is support, that there are perspectives, that there is a chance, not so much to move through it completely, but at least to move with it.
It was absolutely important to me, crucial to me, to talk about it and to discover how many people were in some way touched by a family member or a friend who had committed suicide and who had to come to terms with it. And the ways in which people came to terms with it was always helpful to me. I remember one friend whose brother had killed himself said, "You don't get over it, you get used to it." And that kept up as a refrain in my head. What does that mean, you don't get over it, you get used to it? And now I know what that means.
Yeah.
You know, it no longer hits with the shock that it did at first. And in some ways, Tim is no farther away from me than he was when he was living in Africa.
Hmm.
But and his memories are very present to me. In some ways, the people who are away in any way are present to us only through the pictures in our mind. And that's what I have, and it's sweet, my memory of Tim. You know, to go back to Behind Blue Eyes, when Birgit said that Tim had turned this up on the radio a couple of times, you know, she said he wasn't a bad man. What is he talking about?
Yeah.
But when I listened to those lyrics, you know, he came back from a war he had believed in which he had been disillusioned, to a country that had been against that war from the beginning. And so although I think his own friends were very supportive of him, there was no support for that life he had gone to take part in.
Just to reinvoke some of those lyrics and to understand the conundrum of somebody who is very principled but probably feeling very misunderstood, no one knows what it's like to be hated, to be fated, to tell only lies, but my dreams, they aren't as empty as my conscience seems to be.
Yeah. Yeah, I think all of that raises the hair on my forearms.
Yeah.
You know, with the sense of what that must be like. I should say that Tim had absolutely intense blue eyes, as blue as you have ever seen. And in fact, for a long time, I called this book Behind Blue Eyes. That was my working title.
Uh-huh.
But at some point, I realized that I failed to get behind the blue eyes. That in fact, my own blue eyes are the only ones I am going to get behind. But to be fated to telling only lies, I see that as the sense of possibly PTSD,
yeah,
of depression, of not being able to deal with what was going on in his own head.
So even though PTSD, as you said, is this imperfect diagnosis that just maybe is too vague, too nondescript to be able to say what's going on, it's a label. What's clear to you, though, is that he was conflicted in a way that no one should have to be.
Well, not only was he conflicted, but he also had all of the symptoms that you do use to make a diagnosis of PTSD. He was hypervigilant about the children. He reacted to loud noises. At one point, he was working on the roof of the house, and he was on a 10-foot ladder shaking. And someone noticed that he was shaking and asked Birgit, "Is he afraid of heights?" He was a paratrooper. He was not afraid.
He was jumping out of planes all the time.
He loved jumping out of planes.
Yeah.
So these things are all, they were not normal.
You know, there was a flashback you had to a time, I think it was his time when he was in this dead-end job that you alluded to. He just explicitly said something that at the time kind of bounced off of you or didn't register, but that, you know, he might kill himself, except that he didn't want to do that to you.
Yes, he did say that. And I later looked back and thought, how could I not have latched onto that as just a major clue to what is going on in his mind? He hated desk jobs. He absolutely hated desk jobs. And that was what it registered as for me.
Well, doesn't it in part speak to the universality, though, of something that's very stigmatized, and yet it's a natural inclination? So many of us have ended up in situations where the prospects seem hopeless, our energy seems to have gone out of us. And in that moment, that's a very natural thing to come to mind,
to
ask for the relief that would come.
You know, when Peter and I went to Namibia for Tim's funeral, there was a time that there were a dozen of us standing in the kitchen talking, and there were two people in that group of a dozen who had not at some point considered suicide. Mm. There were two who said, "What are you talking about? No, 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 no." But the rest of us had all been at a low point,
you
including me.
In your own life, just after the dissolution of your first marriage, you were an instructor in the University of Illinois, feeling real anxiety, lack of confidence. You had two young children, all the responsibilities, all this was weighing on you.
I was a mess.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to buy supper in the grocery store. You know, I just felt as if all my capacities had disappeared. And trying to teach was horrifically difficult, you know. There were mornings that I gave the boys their lunch money as they got on the bus, and I felt as if I had done a day's work.
Yeah.
It's just...
In my own life, my own family's history with depression, and going back to difficult high school and thinking of times when those thoughts came to mind, I'm putting in perspective. But again, you know, the other side of that is trying to figure out what does get you through. I think, you know, what Tim cited there, that it is thinking about who you'd leave behind and some of the other things that I think, you know, do bring people through those experiences.
I remember in that difficult time after the divorce, during the divorce, I was seeing a therapist, and I told her that I was having suicidal thoughts. And she said, "Well, you can do that. You're allowed to do that as long as both your parents are dead and your youngest child has reached the age of 18. And I thought, I was talking about not being able to get through today, you know.
So in putting together pieces of the puzzle and ultimately why Tim did take his life, why he was able to, it seems like, you know, one of the pieces, you know, they cite that suicide's more prevalent among men than women.
Yes.
Some of that perhaps is efficacy with weapons or just, you know.
I certainly do think that because he had had this lifelong love affair with guns, the guns were available. And it was, in a very low moment, it was easy to go that route.
As someone who has survived his passing in this way, of course, I'm sure there's anger and there are times when why did you have to do this, Tim? But on the other hand, it sounds like you're deepening in your understanding of the profundity of what he was going through as well, this horrible conundrum that he was trying to be something that he was not being allowed to be.
Yeah, I think that puts it well. Yeah.
You know, so I guess it also strikes me in the process of writing this book. Again, the whole process that you outline is so evocative of this lifelong struggle to come to grips with a relationship with a son who had, you know, a differing belief system, a different way of viewing the world. It was perhaps more linear, more straightforward. This is what I believe. This is what I will do.
Yeah.
Yours being more nuanced. But as you were writing the book, was there a basic dilemma knowing that Tim in some ways, this is an homage to Tim. It is a way to respect him, to allow him to live on, to allow his beliefs to be expressed. And yet, the lessons that you're drawing at the end are perhaps not what, at least in his lifetime, he would have expressed in terms of his concerns.
I was profoundly aware of that. Yeah. That this is the story, is my story of his life and death. It's not his story of his life, or for that matter, of his death.
Yeah.
And in many ways, I tell a different story than he would have told himself, and I reach different conclusions than he would have reached himself. I know that, but I can't know what they were. For me, looking back at it, it seems to me that there were different periods I went through in the writing. The first was anger. Not at Tim, but at the NRA. And the first thing I wrote was an open letter to the NRA. Our gun culture and how it catches young men. And
he was so proud of that he had a lifelong membership
of the NRA. Yeah. Yes, and loved his guns. But that anger came first for me as a writer. Of course, what writers do is write.
Yeah.
And it's the way I make sense of the chaos of life all the time. So it was natural for me to write. But for a long while after that first burst of anger, I was keeping a journal of what I was feeling day after day, just flashing down these terrible feelings. And then I realized that didn't really quite represent the shape of my day, which was memories of Tim. And grief,
yeah.
Memories of Tim and grief. And I thought I should be putting down the memories as well, because that's a way partly to save him,
yeah.
To keep little bits of him alive. And so I started what I remembered as well. And at the same time, I was reading books on suicide, on depression, on the military, and found them so helpful. It was so helpful to read William Styron on depression and A. Alvarez
Joan Didion
on loss.
Yeah.
It was so helpful that I gradually began to think maybe there's a book that can help other people who are going through this.
Of course, a sense of humor is how you get through some of this. And it just struck me, as a pastor's kid, it's inevitable my dad was going to mention me in sermons. As a writer's kid, I'm sure Tim was used to the fact that in your works of fiction and other things.
He was. That's a paradox itself, because he didn't want his picture in the paper. But he liked it when I wrote about it.
Yeah.
And I wrote about the dilemma, that the rift there was between us. And the difference in our worldviews. I often wrote about that. I wrote one essay called Soldier Son about his bringing me guns to admire and how difficult that was for me when he wanted me to admire a gun.
Just another anecdote to pull out of the book that I think is evocative of the way that you get through this. You don't put the lost loved one on a pedestal. You can still joke about them. So the first holiday that you get together, there was this thyme dressing or gravy that he was a specialty for. And you made it for the first time. And he said, well, it's about time, because he always put too much of this ingredient in there.
Right.
And we're going to get
time,
it right this year. The time, literally.
Time.
so that, that is a part of how you process and get through all of this. Yeah. You have a couple of callers on the line. Caller, your comment or question for our guest, Janet Burroway.
Thank you. I think there's probably quite a number of people out in the listening audience who have had an experience like this, maybe not a family member, but an acquaintance. I know someone who was a Vietnam-era vet whose son survived his time in the recent wars only to come home and take his own life. And we all have to deal, all those of us on the ground here have to deal with the adverse effects of this perpetual state of war we seem to be in.
Yes.
Leon Panetta recently made the statement that this issue was the worst problem, the most difficult problem he had ever had to deal with in the course of his long career in public service. Right before he bailed out and dumped the problem in someone else's lap.
Yeah.
We seem to have, a federal government that is largely trying to downplay this issue and, for whatever reasons, cannot come to, terms and really confront it and deal with it openly. Would your guest care to comment?
Yes, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, there are now 22 veterans a day killing themselves. And the best way not to have that happen is not to go to war.
Yeah. As you were reporting these statistics about veterans, we don't keep track of what's happening to the contractors.
We don't keep track of what is happening to the contractors. There is a list of those who have died in the war, but what happens to them when they come home is nobody's business. They are cut off. No VA, no counseling, no debriefing, no GI Bill.
We're into about our last 7 minutes. I knew the time was going to fly by, but that conundrum about why it is we keep going to war. We were talking about Rachel Maddow earlier.
Yeah.
She wrote this book called Drift. You know, the answer seems to be we just sort of drift into it. There are all these forces, corporate entities, other folks that benefit so much from war that we just seem to blindly keep on going into this this destructive process.
There's a wonderful essay by Doris Lessing in which she says, this was written probably back in the 70s, but she says, within the last 30 years then, we have learned more about what goes on in the human brain than in the whole history of civilization before that. And we have not begun to apply it to policy. If a family is not getting along, we bring them in, sit them down and say, all right, we have to figure out a way that you can get along. But if a government is in conflict with another government, we say, hang tough. It makes no sense at all. It simply makes no sense.
So within that, the dilemmas that are there in a time of standing up to a Hitler or standing up to the genocide of a people, the recent dilemma in
it
Libya.
It is not easy.
At our local United Nations Association, Libya was such a conundrum because there were humanitarian concerns. There were concerns about the slaughter of individual people that our intervention might have prevented or perhaps did. And yet it's using the tools of war again, still coming back to that.
Yes.
Those
questions are incredibly difficult and knotty, I think. But when I look at the wars in my life, the Second World War is a whole other issue. We have such a different attitude toward it. But the other wars of my life, Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, are they in better shape because we went in there? You know, did we help?
Yeah.
It's very hard to say that we did.
Because you've experienced such a profound loss, does this place just, a special clarity, a special urgency about needing to get messages like that out and get people to listen?
It does. And I want to reach people who can be helped perhaps by Tim's experience. On the other hand, I have to tell you that I feel fairly hopeless about affecting public policy. I don't know why we must drift into war, but we seem to.
But that doesn't mean you're going to stop trying.
No, it does not. No.
Just to come back to, again, the other aspect of this, the interpersonal lessons learned in dealing with the relatives, depression, suicide, lessons you can learn. Again, you're also feeling a compelling need to, again, perhaps prevent something from happening, just as Tim was able to prevent tragedy from happening as mind sweeping. Is there a parallel, perhaps, as you get these messages out, that meaning someone will see some of the signs or someone will intervene and support someone who's going through
it? I think that is possible. Help helps, and the concern of other people is always useful. I don't know what there is no way to know what the numbers are. How frequently a hotline really does prevent a suicide, how people get to help because they have been, someone has reached out to them. There's no way to count that. But again, you have to try.
We want to refer folks, I'd hope to give folks a better sense of kind of your overall life's work and other things. JanetBurroway.com is one place where they can find out more. Is that right?
Yeah, it's just JanetBurroway.com, all a lowercase.
Also, we should mention Think Peace. Is that the name of the publishing company?
That is the name of the publishing. Think Peace
it's
Publishers.
It's a remarkable new publishing company that really does take to use personal experiences like this and apply them in a socially positive way.
They think of themselves as activists, and they are very active.
So, you know, as we think back in these last few minutes here of your process, you know, again, you've written novels, you've written works of fiction, of course, which have resonant social value, but the fact that you've actually zeroed in on your life experience in this work, is there extra meaning? Does it feel like you've come full circle, like in some ways that there's something special about this process of writing a memoir that's different than what you've done in the past?
Certainly, it is different to work from the material of your own life. Primarily because writing a novel, you are blindly looking for whatever truth there is in this particular fictional situation. Whereas with the life, you want to be as true to the facts as you possibly can, and then as true to their context as you possibly can, and to reach an understanding. In this case, with Tim, it was an understanding that was as close as I could come to reconciling myself.
You had an opportunity to speak to a military group last week with kind of unexpected results.
I spoke at the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in Chicago, and it was peculiar for me, the last place on earth I ever thought would ask me to speak.
The book has just come out. We're privileged to do one of the first interviews that you've had, but are you anticipating some good things to come of the interaction that you'll have that will come out of this?
The interaction that I most hope I will have is with support groups, veteran support groups, VA hospitals, suicide support groups, and so forth.
Is there a mechanism? Is there something in place for families of contractors or folks that are seeking support for
these contractors? There are various online resources, and some of them are listed in the back of the book.
Okay. And we'll put those up on the podcast page that goes
great
together with this. Hey, Melissa, encourage everybody to come back
it
to that beautiful, exactly, that beautiful piece Behind Blue Eyes. But
it is a lovely song.
Again, just to punctuate the basic. Again, the book is just now out, Losing Tim, and it's a memoir by Janet Burroway, again, evoking some very powerful lessons. A tender-hearted and yet hard-eyed book as I have ever read. Janet Burroway's Losing Tim is a pietà in words in honor of a son who succumbed while fighting in two theaters, public and private. It's both an elegy and a call to action by one of our finest writers, says Madeline Blase, Pulitzer Prize-winning author.